Good afternoon. I'm convening this meeting of the House Committee on Revenue. I want to confirm that we're live now.
Yes, we are, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon. This is the House Committee on Revenue, Tuesday, February 23rd. Before we begin our meeting, I'd like to hear the roll call.
Representative Hernandez?
Absent.
Representative Levy?
Here by video, hopefully the whole meeting.
Representative Marsh?
Marsh is here by video.
Representative Smith? Absent. Vice Chair Pham?
Pham is present by video.
Vice Chair Reschke?
Reschke present by video.
Madam Chair Nathanson?
Present by video. I have a few things to announce. First of all, there are four items on our agenda today. We are taking them not in the order they are printed on an agenda that was posted. So please take note, we will do House Bill 2693 first, House Bill 2634 second, House Bill 2331 third, followed by the informational meeting on property tax central assessment and industrial appraisal. So for anyone who is not a member of this committee and not speaking at that time, please keep your camera off and your mic off. It'll just help help with the broadcasting. There's also a reminder that anyone may submit testimony up to 24 hours after the time that the meeting started. Representative Reschke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to note that Representative Smith is just running a little bit late and would ask that he'd be, when he shows up, that he wouldn't be marked as absent.
That's just fine, and we'll welcome him as soon as he gets here.
Thank you.
Thanks. We have 14 people signed up to testify on three bills. Just to give you an indication of how much time you're using, I have asked for a timer to be audible at 3 minutes, hoping that some of you might be able to present your ideas, your comments in 3 minutes or so. We won't be real hard and fast because I think we can still get through our entire agenda if some of those run over 3 minutes, but at least you'll get to hear the time passing and take note that when 3 minutes has passed. Okay, at this time, Mr. Alanak, anything else to cover before I open the first public hearing?
I don't believe so. I believe you touched on all of the housekeeping.
Okay. I'm opening a public hearing on House Bill 2693, Mr. Alanak.
This is Jamie McGovern. I'm the property tax economist, and this is House Bill 2693. There is currently a property tax exemption for property used exclusively for apprenticeship and training by apprenticeship trusts. And this bill would allow that exemption requirement to provide for temporary property use by a tax exempt corporation. And I think we might have some people here to testify, including representatives.
Does that conclude your introduction?
Yes, it's a very short bill.
Thank you.
Thank you.
First, let's hear from Representative Witt.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. Madam Chair and members of the committee, I'm State Representative Brad Witt from Oregon's House District 31, and I'm appearing before you this afternoon in support of House Bill 2693. This is a bill that attempts to unravel the catch-22 that exists between the federal regulation of apprenticeship trusts on the one hand, and how training centers maintain their property tax exemption under Oregon tax codes on the other. This catch-22 was brought to light last summer when UA Local 290 of the plumbers and steam fitters volunteered to work with another nonprofit to distribute food boxes to needy families during the COVID pandemic out of their training facility. Quite simply, Local 290 offered to use its training center both as a place where food could be donated and collected, and then the place that people could come and pick up the food boxes. Herein was the catch-22. Federal regulations require that a training facility be used for training purposes exclusively. So in order for Local 290 to be able to distribute the food boxes, it would have necessitated the trust to have leased out that room in the training facility where the food boxes were stored, to lease that out and make it an entirely separate entity from the training facility. Unfortunately, if they were to do that, the act of leasing out the space would have caused Local 290 and among others who would choose to do the same thing to lose their Oregon property tax exemption. So what House Bill 2693 does is provide a simple fix to this dilemma. It would allow a nonprofit to use an apprenticeship trust training facility for no more than 7 consecutive days or 30 cumulative days in any property tax year under a rental agreement without jeopardizing the facility's property tax exemption. And Madam Chair and members of the committee, when we have so many Oregonians who are challenged economically and financially, I think it is a very worthwhile effort to make sure that our tax code would accommodate the ability of two nonprofits to be able to collect and distribute food to the food insecure. And with that, I would ask for the committee's favorable action on House Bill 2693. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony. Thanks for being with us, Representative Witt.
Appreciate the opportunity. Thank you.
Sure. Next, I'd like to hear from Chris Carpenter, followed by Lou Christian.
There we go. Can you all hear me okay?
I can hear you fine.
Great. Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, my name is Chris Carpenter. I'm here for the Pullman Mechanical Contractors Association and UA Local 290 as well. The PMCA, the Pullman Mechanical Contractors Association, is the contractor employer partners for the UA. And we did work on this issue last summer as it came up. Just as a very quick history on it, when we first looked at doing it, and Representative Witt did an excellent job kind of outlining our dilemmas there, we looked at, those were the issues that we heard back. We heard, okay, we're in this catch-22. So we then went to the county, and Commissioner Treese helped us, hooked us up with the county attorneys to try to figure out, okay, is there, this doesn't seem to make a whole lot of sense given what we're trying to do here. Yes, that was in fact how they interpreted statute as well, that we would lose our property tax exemption should they lease out that property. And then, and thank you, Representative Nathanson, helped also hook 290 up with the Department of Revenue to try to get a little bit more of the tail on this. So we went through that, and yes, indeed, we were still in that same issue. So that's where we landed here, and thank you, Representative Witt, in putting this legislation together and helping us get that drafted with 2693. We do see this is kind of a common sense small bill to just fix a loophole that has left us unable to partner with some of the more community nonprofits in the state. If this passes, it will allow us to work on more of these community-focused nonprofits, because the federal laws under ERISA, they state that we can't give the property away without it being directly related to the administration or the actual functionality of the apprenticeship. And then the state law says that we can't lease it. So this will allow us to do those types of charitable events. Additionally, it will kind of bring us more in line with how other nonprofits currently can function. You know, most are not, and this is very specific to our industry, most are not governed by ERISA because they are not apprenticeship training trusts. So they don't fall under that side of the catch-22. Likewise, it's our understanding that there are certain types of tax-exempt entities who can currently go after and utilize sort of temporary use exemptions so that they can do certain events and things like that without, again, losing their tax exemption broadly. We did limit the scope on this, again, like Representative Witt said, to no more than 7 consecutive days or 30 cumulative days in a tax year. Really wanted to look, this isn't looking at long-term rental agreements. This is very specifically for certain types of charitable events. The other test that we put on there was we limited the types of nonprofits that this can be used in partnership with. Out of, I believe it's 29 different 501c organizations federally, we have 4 501c3s, 4s, 5s, and 6s that we would probably ever reasonably really be doing anything with within these limited time frames for these types of events. So that's where we're at. Really hope that you all can be supportive of the bill. We think it's a pretty small technical fix to this. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Carpenter. Next, Lou Christian.
All right. Can you hear me?
Yes, just fine.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, Chair Nathanson and members of the committee. I'm here today to represent our local union and our Joint Apprenticeship Training Committee. I am the business manager for Plumbers and Steam Fitters Local 290. My name is Lou Christian, and we currently have 6 training centers in Oregon that we manage for our apprenticeship and journeyman training. We have about 600 apprentices. 640 currently in the program, and we do about 50,000 man hours typically a year in journeyman training for licensing and additional skills. And some of that's directly related to maintaining their licenses. We have seen a slowdown with the COVID pandemic, but we will and have shifted to a lot of online classes, but we are looking to get back into our classrooms. And the opportunity to testify today, this issue came up. We had helped contribute to the food bank that was done by the Northwest Oregon Labor Council, and the intent was to make it around the metro area in this case and have something on the southwest side. We're located in Tualatin, and this would make it so that people wouldn't have to drive across town to do this food bank, take advantage of it. And we had just gone through reviewing our tax-exempt status in our facility with Washington County, and the idea came up, well, we better check with our council to make sure that this is something that we wouldn't run into issues with. And when we did was when we found out, as we peeled the layers of the onion off, that we were not going to be able to participate. And we do like to participate in the communities that we're in. We're very much a part of those areas. And because of the federal requirements, we've had to rent the facility from the training center, from our JATC. The local union would have done that. And that would have then caused us to lose the tax-exempt status for the year for the facility. and just made it untenable to be able to do that. It was very disappointing. And so we started, as Chris Carpenter talked about, we started looking at how to try to address this so we can be used in the community and to the advantage of the communities that we're in. And in a crisis situation, we never dreamed that we wouldn't be able to participate in something like this. So this has been worded very narrowly, and this affects us because our training facilities are owned by our Joint Training Apprenticeship Committee, and that is the half of our organization is contractor representatives, half are union representatives, and together we manage that money for the sole benefit of the members for their training and education. And when the local union would rent, we would pay the money to the training trust. They could only spend that money on further education or facilities or equipment for our programs. And this is our way to try to be able to help our communities that we're in, and very much appreciate time to be able to present this to you. Thank you very much.
Committee, it's time now. If you have questions for any of the last three presenters, Representative Marsh.
Thank you, Chair Nathanson. I have a question either for Mr. Alanak or one of the presenters. I'm just wondering about the derivation of the sideboards, the 7 days or 30 cumulative days. Does that parallel restrictions we have in similar situations elsewhere in the property tax realm? Do those restrictions need to be so restrictive? That is, I can understand the 30 days because that sort of reflects on the property tax year as a whole and makes it very clear that for 11 months of the year, there is no, you know, you're doing your core mission. But do you need to have that 7 day limitation?
And this is Chris Carpenter, Chair Nathanson, and Representative Marsh. The 7 days, as far as I know, I don't know if that actually really exists anywhere else. What we were really trying to get out there was just keep it very limited so that there wasn't any, you know, wiggle room for any sort of, for lack of a better term, I mean, foul play around any of this, right? We're trying to keep it very limited, assuming that these types of events, you know, the reason we even went to 7 days was because, you know, some of these might be, okay, we're done in a few hours. Right. Other things could be, oh, we wanted to have some sort of an event with some of these nonprofits that required some setup or something like that. But we really wanted to keep it as strict as possible just to make sure that there wasn't, you know, to really try to make sure that there wasn't any, we didn't create a new loophole or anything like that. That's why we had the 7 days in there, was just to make sure that, you know, there wasn't any room for some sort of anybody to try to monkey around with this.
Thank you.
Chair Nathan, this is Greg. Can I get in the queue?
Certainly, it's your turn. Welcome, Rep. Smith. Go ahead with your question.
Thank you. Actually, I don't have a question, but more of a statement. I've had a chance to look at the legislation, and I think there's a lot of wisdom in what our trades folks are trying to advance here. And so I just want to make sure I get on the record of supporting this concept. Thank you.
Thanks for the comment. Anyone else with comments or questions on this bill? If not, it looks like we're done with this panel. Thank you all three of you for being with us for the public hearing on House Bill 2693. Did anyone else sign up at the last minute that I'm not aware of, Mr. Alanak?
I don't believe so. I'm giving Manny a second to jump in. I think he said there weren't any new signups.
All right.
No, Madam Chair, there's no new signups.
Thank you. I'm ready to close the public hearing unless I hear otherwise. Ms. McGovern, any reason not to close the public hearing now?
No, Madam Chair.
Okay, I'm closing the public hearing on House Bill 2693. Thank you all. Next we have, I'm opening the public hearing for House Bill 2634.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, this is Jamie McGovern again for Legislative Revenue. House Bill 2634 deals with the disabled and senior property tax program. This bill would allow the surviving spouse or disabled heir of the individual whose homestead was granted deferral under the homestead property tax exemption program or property tax deferral program, excuse me, to continue the deferral without having owned or occupied the homestead for the past 5 years. And it would also extend the sunset for the deferral program. Currently, one of the requirements in the property tax deferral program for senior and disabled citizens is that you would have had to live in that homestead for 5 years. And so this would allow that participation of the homestead to continue for the surviving spouse in absence of that 5-year residency requirement. And that's all I have, Madam Chair.
Thank you. I have 4 people signed up to testify on this bill. We'll keep the 3-minute timer just as a sort of an advisory for how much time is passing. First, I would like to hear from the legislators who are present, if they are available right now. I'd like to hear first from Representative Drazen.
Thank you, Chair Nathanson and Vice Chair Spam and Reschke. It's a privilege to be here today. Thank you for hearing House Bill 2634. The need for this particular piece of legislation was brought to me by a constituent in my community, David Fife, who you will hear from today. So I will be brief in my remarks. David's disabled sister had spent her adult life living with her parents in their family home in Canby, and the home had been in this program, in the property tax deferral program, for many years. But with the passing, of course, of David's mom, it was discovered that his disabled sister no longer qualified for the program, placing the family in a very untenable situation where they still required housing for his sister, but had no way to pay off the property tax debt following conclusion of their eligibility in the program. So this situation is addressed in the technical fixes in House Bill 2634. 2634, as you heard, defines disabled heir for the purposes of the homestead property tax deferral program, and with this definition allows the disabled heir to be eligible and to remain in the program, whereas previously it had only been surviving spouse. It also, as you heard, removes the requirement for participants to have had to have lived in the home for the 5 years prior and extends the sunset for this entire program out to 2032. I'd like to note that the agency has a bill in the Senate, Senate Bill 118, which addresses additional technical fixes as well to the homestead property tax deferral program, including a need to increase the allowed home value in rural counties with a low median value and allowing for late filing into the program. And so we have requested amendments to this legislation to allow this House bill to incorporate the agency fixes into a single bill to ensure that all of the necessary technical fixes to the homestead property tax deferral program are included. So all the other elements of this program would remain in effect and are unchanged. So the way that this program works, I'm sure you are familiar with it on this committee, is that the Department of Revenue pays the property taxes on behalf of its program participants, but then a lien is placed on the subject property, and the Department of Revenue becomes a security interest holder at that time. So upon disqualification or cancellation from the program, the participants or the enrollees then must reimburse the Department of Revenue and pay additional interest. So they pay all of the former property taxes plus accrued interest. They pay the cost of recording and releasing the lien, as well as a $55 filing fee on manufactured structures if that is applicable. So I just want to affirm my support for this piece of legislation. I thank you for your consideration. You know, the homestead property tax deferral program is essential to keeping our seniors, and if this is passed and adopted, also members of our disabled community in stable, accessible housing for themselves. And it's so essential and so critical. I really do appreciate your consideration today. Thank you.
Thank you for the testimony. Senator Gelser.
Thank you, Chair Nathanson, members of the committee. For your record, my name is Sarah Gelser. I'm the state senator from Senate District 8, which includes Corvallis, Philomath, Albany, and the surrounding areas. I was very pleased to learn about this issue directly from Representative Drazen last year. And I have to admit, when I first got the note, I was a little bit skeptical and nervous because I served on the Revenue Committee when we had to go through the process of kind of bailing out the property tax deferral program. That was hard, and I know that we don't want to do that again. This does not reimpose that problem. The way that I see this, it's a technical fix to a program that needs to be updated to reflect the reality of the way that families are living today. People with disabilities, intellectual disabilities, physical disabilities, many continue to live with their families throughout their entire lifespan. And often we have elderly parents that continue to be responsible for providing the direct care and support for their adult children with disabilities. When that happens, oftentimes the parents that are providing that care themselves become elderly and disabled and may in fact find themselves on this program. This is especially true given the financial challenges that families often make when they are taking on this lifelong caretaking of a family member. So to me, it only makes sense that when those parents pass, the child that has lived with them, that has continued to stay in that home, not be forced out of that home at that time, not be forced into foster care or some other group living program, but that they be able to continue living in their own family home. And that's really what this bill does. I think it is a great bill, and I'm happy to answer any questions, but I really do urge your aye vote. It will make a significant difference for families and keep people living in the community. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Committee members, do you have any questions for Representative Drazen or Senator Gelser? If not, then they can go on with their other activities and we can hear from the other witnesses who are signed up to testify. Any questions for these two? I don't see any hands. Thank you both for joining us today. Of course, you're welcome to stay with us if you wish, of course. Next, I'd like to hear from David Fife, and that will be followed by Mark Garst.
Yes, Madam Chair and members of the committee, this is David Fife, for the record. And obviously, I'm not as qualified a speaker as some of the speakers before me, but I did want to share my story. My sister has lived in our family home for over 40 years. My parents bought it back in 1980. My dad passed in 92. And my mom passed away in 2019 at the bright age of 95. She's been in the, she was in the deferral program for a little over 10 years. And so I was hoping we could renew this into my sister who has lived in this home for 40 years, but the roadblock came up that she doesn't qualify. This is my sister. Go well and say hello to everyone. Say hello. Hi. Anyway, but so I guess it's just very important for us. I can't imagine my sister now suffers with dementia, schizophrenia, and Parkinson's. And I'm not sure how long she has, but our ultimate goal is for to keep her in our family home for as long as possible. I can't imagine what it would be like to move her out of this home that she's lived in for 40 years. So I would like to thank Representative Drazen for helping me with this. I believe there's a letter and testimony from us too, sort of telling our story. And I guess that's all I have. I support this bill and hope you would consider it. More and more people are living with their adult children and raising them as my parents did. Currently, my wife and I are her care providers, which we cared for my mom too. So anyway, thank you for the time and please consider this.
Don't fight.
That's it.
Thank you very much. Rep. Pham, would you like to wait till after the next speaker, or is it for this one?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to express appreciation to Mr. Fife for his testimony, for sharing his story. I'm very grateful for our technologies to allow him to be able to share a story. Mr. Fife, you said you were not as eloquent as the representatives and senator, and I found your story incredibly helpful and eloquent, and just thank you for taking the time to share your story.
Thank you. Next is Mark Garst.
Yes, Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, Mark Arts with the League of Oregon Cities. The League strongly supports House Bill 2634, including both the sunset extension for the deferral program as well as the relaxing the criteria for qualification to allow disabled heirs to access the program. The deferral program is really a lifeline for a lot of folks in our cities. And, you know, obviously as an organization where we're so dependent on property taxes, the notion that there's a program like this out here in the state that allows folks to stay in their home, even when they might have a limited income, is very important. I do know that, you know, the participation in the program has dropped a little bit in recent years, but I think that, you know, as demographics start to hit us and we start to see what the demographers call that silver tsunami of baby boomers kind of aging into when they might be eligible for the program, I do think that we're going to see some increased use in the future. I just wanted to hit on kind of what Representative Drazen already said, and that is that there are a couple of other bills out there this session that also address the senior deferral program. She mentioned Senate Bill 118, which includes some fixes that the Department of Revenue was looking to get, and, you know, and we would support those changes as well. And then finally, I also wanted to point out Senate Bill 18, and that is Senator Finley's bill that would do two things. It would address the issue of folks in some of the counties out there with lower median price homes not being able to access the program because part of the qualification criteria is based upon the median value in your county. And then secondly, it would allow a path for folks to do a late application to get into the program. Currently, seniors will often not figure out that they have an issue with paying their property taxes until they actually get the bill in November, but by then it's too late for them to actually apply for the program. So this would fix that. If it sounds familiar, it's because the House actually dealt with this bill in 2019. At that time, it was Representative Finley, who was on the House Revenue Committee, brought that bill, and it passed the House only losing one vote. Now, it went on to the Senate, and it was really just a function of timing that it never got a hearing in Senate Finance and Revenue, and the Senate was not able to move the bill. And so we would be very hopeful that those changes as well would make it in and allow folks a little bit better opportunity to access the program. So that is what I have for you today. Thank you so much.
Thank you for the testimony and the additional historical context. Representative Reschke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just ask LRO, maybe we could get not today, but maybe it's sometime in the future, get a quick recap of the program and where it does sit as far as funding available so we can have a clear picture of what some of these additions would cost as far as making sure the program remains sustainable.
Rep. Reschke, Chair Nathanson, I can get you a more detailed summary, but I can give you a little bit of information right now if you'd like. The fund for that program currently sits at around $50 million. Over the past decade, the participation in terms of number of people has dropped by about half, but the payments that are going out per property are about $2,600 a year. And so interestingly, with the sort of the values of properties going up, but the participation dropping, the sort of payments are kind of holding steady. And so in recent years, the money that's coming into the program is larger than the money that's going out, which is what's been growing towards that $50 million. But that's just a short summary, and then I can get you some more detail of where things are at.
Thank you, Ms. McGovern. That's fantastic.
Sure.
Manny, was there anyone else who signed up at the last minute? who's not on the list that I have?
No, that was the last person for House Bill 2634.
Thank you. Committee, any final questions or comments before we close this public hearing? Okay, I'm closing the public hearing on House Bill 2634. We are now ready for the final public hearing. I'm opening a public hearing on House Bill 2331.
Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, it's Jamie McGovern again for legislative revenue. And House Bill 2331 would exclude over-the-air broadcasting from the meaning of communication for purposes of central assessment for property taxation. This wouldn't remove certain property from the property tax system or provide an exemption, but instead take over the air broadcasting and specify that it was not meant to be assessed by the Department of Revenue for purposes of central assessment. And this, so I'll just say that the default per property tax assessment outside of what we think of as utilities or railroads, these sort of connected companies, the default is that the local county assessor assesses those properties and gives value. The connected value portion or that idea is the central assessment component that we think of from the Department of Revenue, and they have very specialized assessors for that type of property. This would essentially say that that over-the-air broadcasting would not be subject to that sort of DOR treatment. And so it's not an exemption. It's just sort of, I would say, moving back to that default of the local assessment.
Committee, any questions for Ms. McGovern before we go to public testimony? Okay, thanks. We have about seven people signed up to testify. Our first speaker will be Representative Bonham.
Thank you, Chair Nathanson. For the record, my name is Daniel Bonham. I represent House District 59, which is North Central Oregon, Wasco, Jefferson, Wheeler, and Northern Deschutes County, including the territories of the Confederated Tribes of Warm Springs. I appreciate you hearing this bill this morning. House Bill 2331. As a result of a 2014 Oregon Supreme Court decision and a 2019 Oregon Tax Court decision involving Comcast and the Department of Revenue, over-the-air broadcasters were brought into central assessment after decades of being assessed locally. Local free over-the-air broadcasters have a different business model than subscriber-based large multi-state communications companies. The definition of communications in the central assessment statutes currently is overly broad and I believe was not intended to capture local television and radio stations. This new direction will bring over-the-air broadcasters, many of whom are very small operators, into a central assessment, likely increasing their tax liability. What this bill is trying to do is to modify the definition of communication in statute to exclude traditional over-the-air broadcasters and allow them to continue to be assessed at the county level, just as with other small businesses throughout the state. I appreciate you taking the time to hear this bill today and your consideration.
Thank you. Committee, any questions or comments for Representative Bonham? You're welcome to stay with us, of course, but if you need to get on to other business.
I'm going to head back to rules. Thank you, madam.
Sure. We have some other speakers ready now. I'll list them in the order that I'm going to call them so that you can be prepared. Matt McCormick, Zach Reeves, Seiji Shiratori, Bob Wise, Mark Garst, and Bob Singer. First, Matt McCormick.
Hopefully, there we go. I think I've got the, hopefully I'm on camera and hopefully
we hear you just fine. Just state your name for the record.
Thank you very much. I'm Matt McCormick from the law firm of Fletcher, Heald & Hildreth. I am a counsel for the Oregon Association of Broadcasters, and along with my colleague Christopher Robinson of the CKR Law Group. We've been advising the OAB regarding the impact of central assessment on broadcast stations. And first of all, I'd also like to say thank you to Madam Chair Nathanson and Vice Chair Pham and Vice Chair Reskin for allowing us to speak at this hearing. This is a very important measure for broadcasters in Oregon. The purpose of the bill, as Representative Bonham hit right on the head, is to make sure that Oregon broadcast stations remain locally assessed, as they have been since the advent of broadcasting in the state nearly 100 years ago, rather than being centrally assessed, as is intended by the currently intended by the Department of Revenue. Central assessment is anticipated to significantly increase the tax burden on broadcast stations because the inclusion of intangible property in the station's assessed value. Such an increase could be devastating to local broadcast operations. Let me explain as briefly as I can how we got here. Since 1909, Oregon has had a central assessment system for property operated as a network over a large geographical area. Properties subject to central assessment included that of railroad companies, telegraph companies, telephone companies, pipelines. It also included utility-type companies as long as they were operated as a system and cross state or county lines. Now, over the years, the central assessment statute has been changed and reorganized, but for our purposes, the key change occurred in 1973. The 1973 legislation included communications, I'm putting air quotes around that, among the industries to be centrally assessed. The term communications was defined in the statute to include telephone communications, telegraph communications, which was later dropped, and, quote, data transmission services by whatever means provided, close quote. That last phrase back in 1973, the kind of focus of it was this huge microwave network that MCI was building between Seattle and San Diego. And Oregon wanted to make sure that that network would be centrally assessed. So things went on. Central assessment worked very smoothly, it would appear. Roughly 36 years later, beginning with the 2009-2010 tax year, the Oregon Department of Revenue asserted that cable television systems and internet access services should be treated as communication services and thus subject to central assessment. Comcast challenged that conclusion. The case eventually went to the Oregon Supreme Court. In 2014, the court rendered its decision in Comcast Corporation versus Department of Revenue. In that case, they decided that the phrase data transmission services, the words that were in the statute, is defined as services that provide the means to transmit data, and again, I quote, from one computer or computer-like device to another across a transmission network. The court also concluded that Comcast was covered by central assessment. Now, among the arguments that Comcast advanced was that if cable television and internet services were to be treated as centrally assessed, it would be impermissibly discriminatory under the statute to not also centrally assess broadcast stations. The Supreme Court did not decide the issue. It did observe, almost as an aside, in a footnote, that over-the-air television and radio involved matters of means of communications that differ significantly from that of cable television. The court noted, among other things, there's no subscriptions, no fees required, nor do broadcasters control who listens to their programming. The Supreme Court remanded the case to the tax court to deal with other issues presented on remand. And on remand, Comcast continued to argue that it was, in their view, it was impermissibly discriminatory not to centrally assess over-the-air broadcasting. As the case went on and on and on, eventually the by the way, no broadcasters were parties to that litigation.
So, Mr. McCormick, excuse me for the interruption. We're at about 5 minutes now. I noticed that there is someone else signed up from OAB to testify. Will that be similar testimony?
I don't think so. I think that testimony will be more directed to the exact impact central assessment would have on the broadcast stations. I can wrap this up. We'll wrap this up very quickly and say that the objective here, and I have written testimony and I will offer it to the committee as well.
Good. Yes, please do. And be sure that you get it in by 1 o'clock tomorrow, so that we can add it to the public record for today.
Absolutely. I absolutely will do this. And I am sorry for being long-winded. But I wanted to give you some of the background and where we wound up. And the Department of Revenue has now said we're going to centrally assess broadcasters. We think that we need to step back and say this is not what central assessment was intended for. It's not intended for single situs broadcast stations. They're not a transmission network. There's individual stations in individual locations whose coverage is limited by what the FCC gives them. So to wrap this up, we ask that you consider our bill. It is we've tried to make it a simple bill to simply take broadcast, over the air broadcasting, out of central assessment and leave it where it has always been, local assessment. Thank you very much for your consideration.
Thank you. Committee, I'd like to hear from Mr. Reeves next, and then if you have questions for those two, we'll take those. Zach Reeves.
Thanks, Chair Nathanson, Vice Chair Pham, Vice Chair Reske. I'm Zach Reeves. I'm here today on behalf of the OAB. As Matt just said, House Bill 2331 would exempt local over-the-air broadcasters from central assessment and keep them assessed at the county level, just as they have been for the decades they've been operating. As Ms. McGovern said, central assessment was implemented to assign value to property as a component of an integrated system. And Oregon's local television and radio stations are not part of an integrated system, but rather they're mostly small businesses providing a free service to their community. So, we understand that both DOR and the local governments are proposing an amendment to this bill that would more specifically define who we're trying to exempt from central assessment. We would be happy to work with them to craft language that works for everybody. And that's a conversation that we'll continue to have. So thanks thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you. Committee, any questions for these two witnesses? Rep. Pham.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Vice Chair Reske, I did have a clarifying question. I've heard several, both speakers talk about how it has been this way for decades. When did it start? What was the year that it started to be centrally assessed?
This is Matt McCormick. It would be starting in the 2021-2022 tax year. The Department of Revenue is moving forward now with its intentions to centrally assess.
Thank you.
Anyone else? Thank you both, but could you please stay available in case anything else comes up?
Absolutely.
Thank you. Next, Seiji Shiratori.
Okay, thank you, Chair Nathanson, committee members. Sage Shiratori, Oregon Department of Revenue, Property Tax Division. We do not have a position on this bill, aside from trying to interpret the Supreme Court's definitions. We would defer to the legislature on whether to take local broadcasters out of central assessment or not. But in terms of administering this, as Mr. Reeves referred to, we would request some sort of definition of what is an over-the-air broadcaster, as referenced in this bill. We were researching this a little bit as the bill came up and found that there are at least four possible definitions of over-the-air broadcasting. Any of them are fine, but it would be helpful to pick one. In administering this, we will be expected to know, well, what exactly is a company that is in or out. We think, as Mr. McCormick was ably describing, that this is not, that the bill is not intended to touch, well, wireless, fixed line, cable, or internet, but it is only intended to talk about your local television and radio broadcasters, with a definition that is probably something like transmitting via an electronic signal to an audience that would receive that signal via antennas. In any case, some sort of definition would be helpful, and that's all I really have to say. I'd be happy to answer questions. Thank you.
I'd like to hear from the next two, and then we will have continue to have opportunities for committee questions and comments. Bob Wise, I'd like to hear from you, and then after that, it will be Mark Garst and Bob Singer. So, Bob Wise, next.
Are you seeing me and hearing me?
I can see you and hear you now.
Yay! Chair Nathanson, members of the committee.
But Bob Wise, would you mind turning off what's broadcasting in the background?
Oh, certainly. Please. That's a really good idea. If I can find my other remote. You know, I am in TV, so I apologize for that. Our station is owned by Patsy Smullen, whose father founded our station in 1953. KLBI-TV has served our viewers for 68 years, providing news and information of importance to those we reach. Our company also owns KLSR-TV in the Eugene area, and that station was founded by the Smullens in 1987, 34 years ago. With Patsy Smullen, we have an owner who is one of the few independent television owners left in this country. I've been in my position since 2004. Since that time, we have had to completely change our business paradigm as economic challenges have faced our organization. But we have never stopped being fully committed to providing safety and emergency alert operations and daily local news regarding our area and beyond. Important news, such as evacuation information just south of Medford, Talon, and Phoenix that happened last year, information regarding COVID, obviously, or weather information that impacts the eight counties we deliver information to. Our FCC license for us and all other broadcasters is the most important part of being a free over-the-air broadcast operation. The FCC license says the following. We expect station licensees to be aware of the important problems and issues facing their local communities and to foster public understanding by presenting programming that relates to those issues. Adding a significant tax burden to free over-the-air broadcasters from the unintended consequence of the Comcast decision in 2014 would be incredibly difficult for us. It will cost jobs. It'll severely impact our ability to continue to provide vital and important information to our viewers. Trust me, a central assessed tax will not only impact us, it will hurt counties like Lake, Coos, Curry, and I could go on and on. No other state in the country has a tax for free over-the-air broadcasters like the one intended for us. We free over-the-air broadcasters do not have a revenue stream like Comcast because they are a subscription revenue. A centrally assessed tax on businesses will hurt Oregonians because they will lose information that is vital to them. Now, because of court cases involving the cable industry, not local broadcast, we may be centrally assessed. And that'll add a significant tax burden to us and other local broadcasters. Please stop this process of moving forward from local assessment to central assessment. And thank you very much. And my apologies for the TVs being on behind me.
Thank you for your testimony. Committee, any questions or comments while Mr. Wise is with us? Representative Marsh.
Thank you. Mr. Wise, normally I, under different circumstances, I would thank you for making the 4-hour trip to Salem to sit in our hearing room and provide that testimony. We're glad that wasn't required this time, but I appreciate you chiming in. I think it's really important to understand the implications of these for facilities like yours, which have been play a really important role within the community. And we've certainly experienced that over the past years of crises that have been on our plate in Southern Oregon. So thank you for being here.
Well, thank you, Representative Marsh, and thank you for your service to our region and beyond.
Thank you again for your testimony. We'll hear next from Mark Garst, followed by Bob Singer.
Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, again, Mark Garst with the League of Oregon Cities. We have submitted testimony along with our local government partners, the Association of Oregon Counties and the Special Districts Association of Oregon. LOC does not have a position on the bill at this time, but we are watching this conversation very carefully. Central assessment is, local governments are highly dependent on central assessment for property tax revenues currently. There was over $28 billion in assessed value on the 2020 roll in the central assessment program generally, and about $6.8 billion of that was attributed to communication companies. And if you wanted to kind of do a rough back of the napkin to put that into tax dollars, at the average statewide rate per assessed value of $17 per thousand, you'd be looking at about $481 million from the central assessment program overall and $115 million from communication companies. We really urge caution during these conversations. I think that many of you were here during the conversations around Senate Bill 611 in 2015. We made a lot of changes then to address some of the issues with the central assessment of communication companies. And were these companies to be centrally assessed, they would receive an exemption, for instance, of their FCC licenses. So there were some changes made at that time that would address these companies. The central assessment of communication companies, as has been mentioned, has been heavily litigated. So kind of the gold standard is the Comcast Supreme Court decision from 2014, and that determined what data transmission was under the current law. And so obviously any changes to that, you know, we would just want to make sure that they're very clear and that we understand what the implications would be. You know, it's funny, Comcast was originally pulled into central assessment in 2009 because some of their competitors complained that it was discriminatory that they were being centrally assessed where Comcast was not. And then these companies now, we're talking about pulling them into central assessment here in 2021. And again, the reason is because Comcast said that, you know, it would be discriminatory to centrally assess Comcast, but not these companies. You know, local governments don't have a position on this legal issue, but I think that, you know, you can see from how things are working out where the Department of Revenue is probably at on what the current law is. The Oregon property tax system is broken. We have constitutional limits under Measures 5 and 50 that prevent your local residents from making meaningful decisions on how to fund local services. We have not gone around and asked for the list of companies that would be subject to be central assessment to be expanded, but at the same time, we're concerned about any changes that would weaken the central assessment program, lead to removing existing companies from the central assessment role, or prevent future companies that might come in with a new technology competing against these existing companies from being centrally assessed. So, you know, to that end, at the very least, you know, we're listening to the Department of Revenue and what they say about how we might tighten up this definition a little bit. You know, currently we centrally assess satellite companies, for instance, you know, Dish, DirecTV, which I think are now consolidated. But, you know, we centrally assess those companies, and one could argue because that signal travels through the air, that they are over-the-air broadcasters. So we certainly want to mistakenly exempt, you know, those companies from central assessment because we were trying to address this these terrestrial companies. So, you know, that is what I have for you today. We're going to be watching this. I don't envy Legislative Revenue Office trying to come up with a, you know, revenue impact on this bill. I expect it's going to be quite challenging. These companies have not filed for central assessment yet. And so, you know, we don't have much of an idea really how much money we're talking about here. But presumably there is some increase in taxes that these companies would see if they were to be paying on their intangible property. So that's what I have for you today, and I'm happy to take any questions.
Thank you. Let's hear next from Mr. Singer, and then we'll have committee questions for either of you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate it very much, and members of the Revenue Committee. My name is Bob Singer, and I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Association of Broadcasters. Much of what has been said already, I will try not to repeat so we don't get to go too long here. But the key phrase is the unintended consequence of broadcasters being brought into central assessment. The vast majority of stations, with the exception of a handful, are owned by families and individuals with a single station in a small rural area that reach with a signal of maybe 15 or 20 miles. And in most of these rural areas, the radio is the primary source of local news and information. And in times of disasters, this is where they turn to local radio stations. This additional tax levied on these stations, and to reiterate, this is an additional tax, will hinder their operations greatly. I've heard from many small broadcasters that worry about their future if central assessment goes forward. Our association pursued all avenues to keep our stations from being centrally assessed. And we determined the statutory fix would be the best option. In light of the recommended amendment from the Department of Revenue today, we would be happy to work with them, as Zach said, to craft some language that captures exactly what we're trying to accomplish with House Bill 2331. And I believe with the Department of Revenue, we can boil this down and appease everyone. So I want to thank you for your consideration of the bill, Madam Chair and members of the Revenue Committee.
Thank you. Thank you, both of you, for your testimony. Committee, do you have questions? Yes, Rep. Pham.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Nathanson. Yes, Mr. Singer, you mentioned that the vast majority of the broadcasters are small broadcasters. How do you distinguish what are small? What's the definition of a small broadcaster?
I would consider a small broadcaster as one who is licensed just in the state of Oregon, no stations outside of Oregon. They have had the FCC license for many years and derive all of their income from selling commercials in between songs. That's for radio. As for television, yes, there are a number of stations, for example, in the Portland market that are large national companies. And like I said, that is just a handful. There are probably 60 or 70 small broadcasters that operate solely one station in one market. And that's who I'm most concerned about.
Thank you.
Yep. Any other questions or comments for these two? Rep. Pham, did you have another question or comment?
No, apologies. I meant to put down my hand.
Thank you. Thank you. Ms. McGovern.
Yes, Chair Nathanson.
We've heard a little bit about is there anything that needs clarifying or refining or fine-tuning? Can you please comment for just a moment before I close this public hearing on any points you anticipate we either do need or might want an amendment for?
Chair Nathanson, on the policy question, I think that the Department of Revenue, their statement about there being potential definitions, if you choose one of the various definitions or create a new one, they each could have different policy implications on the breadth or the expansiveness of what you would or would not include. And so I would just say that you know, I think that these kinds of things are always moving in the sense that the technology is evolving. And so to the extent that that can be paid attention to in crafting what the members are interested in, the definition and the terminology in the bill right now is literally just the over-the-air broadcasting. So a little bit more could be added to that if the goal was to keep the scope small.
I would like for you to be prepared to come back at a future meeting and provide us some options.
Absolutely.
Rep Pham and then Rep Marsh.
Thank you, Chair Nathanson. Yes, I just, along those lines, I did want to raise some questions about the possibility of these larger national corporations that Mr. Singer was mentioning, and how to make sure that they're that we were differentiating between these small local broadcasters and these national broadcasters. And did want to ask the LRO if we had, I know it's going to be challenging, but if we could get a number of how many broadcasters would be impacted and what would be the estimated revenue impact.
Thank you, Representative Pham. Chair Nathanson.
And also, if we could talk about the size. I'm sorry, one last question. Just this, in addition to the number of broadcasters, but the size of the broadcasters in terms of their sales or how big their coverage area is.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Thank you.
Rep. Marsh.
Thank you, Chair Nathanson. Along these same lines, I am wondering, Jamie, of course, I haven't seen the potential definitions, so we're all kind of wandering in the dark till we see those. But can you comment on what role, if any, the business model could have in the delineation of affected entities? For example, some broadcasters, the broadcasters we heard from today are issuing content without requiring the end user to do anything, to pay anything. Is that, from the outside, that's distinctively different than a cable company that requires you to pay $23 a month to get that content. Is that element legitimately part of a distinction as we look at property tax issues?
Chair Nathanson, Representative Marsh, they say it's a little off the cuff, and I'm potentially in a little over my skis in the sense that I'm a revenue economist, and I'm speaking a little bit about the business models for these different companies. So, again, it's all policy options for the committee, but in terms of the potential types of definitions, you know, one approach could be that you're looking at the way that the physical structure is composed, the ownership of the property and how connected it is, like in the case of Comcast and the wires and these kinds of things, versus the companies that are radio stations. There are, antennas that people use to receive these signals, but the companies don't own the air in between or anything like that. And then there's a completely separate type of approach, which is this idea of, like, instead of the physical structure of the business, but how the revenue is gained from the business, the subscription type model. And so it takes a different approach at defining what the intended target or the over-the-air broadcaster is. So I think that I haven't looked at all of the definitions that the Department of Revenue is speaking of, but I think that there's different, not just different definitions, but different ways of defining the type of business or corporation or group that you're interested in. So I'll work on those types of things for you as well.
Great, thank you so much.
Please plan on us having a continued conversation at another meeting. I want to be sure to leave enough time for our informational meeting, which is on the topic of central assessment and industrial appraisal. Are there additional questions or comments from the committee right now before I close this public hearing? Mr. Shiratori, did I see that you wanted to respond to something?
Oh, sure, Nathan, no, I was just jumping the gun on the presentation.
Okay. Anything else? Rep. Marsh, did you have another question?
I did not, Chair Nathan, thank you.
Good. That concludes our list of speakers for today. Manny, I'm just double checking with you one last time, Mr. Singer. That concludes the list, is that correct?
Yes, it does, Madam.
Thank you. Okay, I'm closing the public hearing on House Bill 2331. Expect continued conversation at a future date. I'm now opening an informational meeting for Property Tax Central Assessment and Industrial Appraisal.
Okay. Chair Nathanson, committee members, Sage Shiratori, Oregon Department of Revenue, Property Tax Division. Thanks for the time for this. I did have a couple of slides. I don't know if they're available. They're sort of optional, but if we want to come to the first one, that would be great. And actually advance to the next slide. There we go. So now that we've all sort of tripped into the deep end of a central assessment topic, let's come back into the shallows for a little bit of a primer on just how do we value these complex transportation, communication, utility systems, and industrial manufacturing sites? And also, what are the three approaches that we use to try to determine this value as accurately as possible? So jumping right in, I've divide this up kind of conceptually into three types of property for appraisal and assessment, and I'll explain each one: central assessment, state appraisal, and local assessment. And I'll start with the central assessment because my sense is that once we all become comfortable with that topic, the other two topics become relatively easier to grasp. So central assessment, what kinds of companies are subject to central assessment in Oregon? The answer is in ORS 308.515, and the list is pretty clear. The transportation companies, airlines, railroads, waterborne transportation on the inland waterways, the utilities, pipelines, heating, gas, electricity, and the communication companies, which, as has already been noted, fixed line, wireless, internet, cable, and starting with the tax year beginning July 1st, 2021, the local radio and television broadcasters. I will skip the background on that because we just heard it. Now, so what does it mean to be under central assessment, and how does that work? A couple of theoretical underpinnings might be helpful. One is that these are typically properties that are somewhat geographically extensive. They may span more than one county, may span more than one state, or more than one country. That's not always the case. You might find examples of a single site, such as the Hermiston Power Generation Plant, for example, and several others that are just one site, but are under central assessment in Oregon because ORS 308.515 says that that's the type of company that they are. The theory there is that they extend past more than one geographic boundary. The other theoretical underpinning is that the value is often the value of the whole is often, but not always, greater than the value of the sum of the parts. And maybe I can give an example that would help with that. So let's take a theoretical electricity utility company. And what is that? It may be some power generation stations, it may be some cables, some utility poles, transformers. And if we tried to value each of those distinct pieces of property, what might that look like? It might look like, we spool up all of that cable and figure out, well, what is that cable worth? We might lay out all the utility poles and figure out, well, what is the value of cut logs today? But the theory of a central assessment is that when you set these up and connect them in a network, and then you transmit electricity down those cables, you add to that some skilled labor, for example, to help maintain and operate it, then the value is greater than just power stations, transformers, cables, and utility poles. So that's the theoretical background. How do we apply this? We apply this by, unlike all other sort of appraisal and assessment in the state of Oregon, for central assessment, we're using what we call a unit valuation, also known as a system valuation, taking the whole thing. So in our hypothetical example, let's say that electrical utility ran a little bit through Oregon, Idaho, and Washington State. We would take the value of that company as a whole. And then we would apportion that out, the value to Oregon, and then to the relevant counties, and then to the relevant tax code areas. And an important point that's been noted earlier today is that when doing that, we're capturing not only the tangible value, but also the intangible value of the corporate goodwill, things like trademark, patent, trade name, human resources, and these intangibles. So that's how it works. Some examples, how would we value, let's say, an airplane? Well, in that case, we would go back to the ownership. If that airplane is owned by an airline, well, there we go. The statute says that it would be part of central assessment. If, on the other hand, I own the airplane and I'm using it for my own personal pleasure, or I'm hiring myself out as a crop duster, elsewhere in Chapter 308, it says that that type of airplane is exempt from ad valorem property taxation. Another example, natural gas pipelines. Well, there they are in the ORS 308-515 to be centrally assessed. How about a cogeneration facility? There's a little nuance on this one, because actually if you look at ORS 308-516, there are some exemptions for a biomass or wood generating facility of 20 megawatts or less that is not selling to consumers but only selling to a utility. There's also an exception for a producer that's primarily producing for their own use, not to be sold. But in general, these cogeneration facilities are going to be under central assessment as utilities. So there's the central assessment for you. Now moving over to state appraised industrial property, what is that? That is industrial manufacturing sites, and in that we include food processors that have a real property value of $1 million or more. And in real property, this is not including the land in this case. This is the buildings, the improvements, the real property, machinery, and equipment. And I say real property, machinery, and equipment because there is also, that's the big, fixed, immobile, sometimes rather unique type of equipment, different from personal property, machinery, and equipment, which is smaller and mobile. And just in case you're wondering, recall that in Oregon, personal property for personal use is exempt from property tax. Personal property for business use is not exempt. But in describing what these industrial manufacturing sites are, we're talking about real property, machinery, and equipment, and the buildings and improvements. So we value that at the state level. We transmit that value to the relevant county. The county combines that with their appraisal of that land and then puts that together and uses that to assess that taxpayer. So that's the basics of state appraised industrial property. The third category, the locally assessed property, which is administered by your county assessor, is pretty much everything else. Your residence, your mom and pop restaurant, fancy hotel, big box store, farmland, forest land, everything else. So there we have the main categories of property and how they differ from each other. Now, if we can advance to the next slide, let me just talk about how we determine the value as accurately as possible using these three approaches. And the key here is that there are three approaches. So if any one of them runs into limitations because of insufficient information, most likely, then that limitation can be mitigated by combining it with the other two approaches. So the three approaches are the cost approach, the income approach, and the market approach. In the cost approach, we're just taking a look at what it would cost to obtain a substitute for a given piece of property that's of equal utility. And then once determining that cost, we apply depreciation to it, and depreciation comes from industry standards and charges and such. Then there's the income approach. The income approach is using an estimate of future income to estimate the property's value today, not last year's income, not historical income, but future income. And then finally, the market approach. There's a couple of main methods that are used under the market approach. One is sales comparison, and that's probably somewhat familiar, where you look at similar properties that have sold in a similar area at a similar time and use that to to learn what the market has to say about the value of that given property. And by the way, this is one of the reasons why with state appraised industrial property, it is state appraised, because if, for example, we're talking about a sawmill in a given county, well, how often is it that a similar sawmill in a similar location is sold? So we scope out a little bit further to look at the state, not just the county, to try to get some more comparators. That's not always going to give us everything we need. The other method in the market approach is stock and debt, which is add up all the equity, add up all the debt, combine it, and there's another way that the market can tell us about the value of a property. So there we go. There's the basics, three different types of property and three different ways that we appraise and assess. The three methods that we use to try to estimate the value as accurately as possible. And that's pretty much it. So I'll just stop there and answer questions if I can. Thank you.
Thank you for the presentation. Committee members, questions or observations about the information that's just been presented? I'll leave a minute or so here for you to ponder that. Representative Marsh.
Thank you, Chair Nathanson. I have a question that's I'm just still formulating in my mind, but when I look at the categories around central assessment on your property tax appraisal types, communication, energy, transportation, it seems to me that those are all significant because you know you can identify the end users in those cases. A transportation system, you know where it starts, you know where it ends. A data line starts one place, you can identify. Or is that a commonality there? I guess that is the question. Energy systems, you know where the end, I think you do know where the end customer is. Just in terms of, you know, our calculation of, I mean, part of the intention here is that these are systems that flow well beyond the boundaries of a county in many cases. So you have to be able to identify where you start and where you end. So I guess the question is that a commonality of all those to this point?
Yeah, Chair Nathanson, Representative Marsh, that's a good question. As you ask that question, I'm trying to go through in my head to think of an example that would counter that idea, and I haven't been able to. Okay. If I may, I'll take that for homework, though, and make sure that I'm not misleading you there.
Great. Thank you so much.
Oh, Mr. Shiratori, one of the things that had been explained to me many years ago is that central assessment is complex, and we have a number of counties that are just not staffed adequately to have specialists trained and available year round for the few times a year that they would need to apply this, and that it was in part at least a matter of having adequate background and experience and training, if you will, professional training. I don't know if it requires certification to understand how to do this because it's pretty complicated. Is that the case that we have, we probably just don't have that expertise at the county level across the board for all of Oregon's counties?
Yes, Chair Nathanson, that's exactly correct. I don't want to cast disparagement on any of the counties, but that's exactly right. Maybe some of the bigger counties, but in general, you know, we have several dozen folks at the department who do nothing but this state appraisal or central assessment, and they're far smarter than I, and it does take a specific education for it. So it's not something that most counties have.
There's something else I wanted to ask about. Even though it might be generally true that those big categories that were just mentioned, generally they cross county boundaries, but they don't have to.
Yes, Chair Nathanson, that's correct. They don't have to. There are more than a few examples of just one power plant or just one set of gas pipelines or what have you that does not cross more than one county boundary.
I think that's an important note for us to take. Representative Pham.
Thank you, Chair Nathanson. Yeah, I'm still trying to make sure I understand these three property tax appraisal types. Mr. Sciarratore, I know you had said earlier, I was taking notes and I think I might've gotten it wrong because I read under state appraised industrial, I was trying to track the process for assessing the value. And then I heard you say something like, and then we pass it to the counties and then the counties assess the value. Can you clarify the process for the state appraised industrial?
Yes, Chair Nathanson, Representative Pham. I know what you're talking about there. It's that on the state appraised industrial, the counties appraise the land, but on the same site, we're doing the appraisal of the buildings, the improvements, and the machinery and equipment, the real property machinery and equipment. So that's how the two come together.
I see. Follow-up question, Chair Nathanson?
Sure.
Thank you, Mr. Sciarratore. That helps a lot. I think I was like, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And also, are the three valuation methods that you outlined, just dropped something, cost, income, and market, are they the same methods that are used in local assessment as well?
Yeah, Chair Nathanson, Representative Pham, to the best of our abilities, and it really is limited by availability of information, we try to use all three all the time or have a very good reason for not doing so. But without getting ahead of my skis, as Jamie would say, there are some properties types that lend themselves more to certain approaches and others that lend themselves to other approaches. But in general, using all three is the best way to assess any type of property.
Thank you.
Committee, any other questions for Mr. Sciarratore? Okay, I don't see any. Thank you for being with us and presenting this information.
Thank you.
Mr. Alanak or Ms. McGovern, do you have any comments that you would like to share with us as a follow-up during this informational meeting before I close the informational meeting?
Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, Representative Pham, just to add to Sage's response to your question at the local level, when it comes to assessing I think property that we're really familiar with, while all those methods are absolutely correct and triangulated, but multiplicatively used, when it comes to Oregon's unique property tax system, when we think of our business and residential property locally, we are constrained by the Measure 5 and Measure 57 or Measure 50 system constitutionally, which means that our assessed value is sort of formulaically calculated annually based on previous year's values and sort of an upward track, which is prescribed both in statute and in the Constitution. So there's an additional component at the local level when we're talking about our normal assessments.
Thank you. Thank you. That's helpful.
Anything else on the informational meeting? In a moment, I'm going to close the informational meeting, but not adjourn quite yet for just some finishing business. Okay, I don't see any other hands up. I'm closing the informational meeting. So before I close today, for Mr. Alanak, Ms. McGovern, there were a few times when we heard in public testimony in a public hearing for a bill that an amendment either was being prepared or would be prepared or maybe should be prepared. So I just wanted to make sure that we all have notes. For example, I believe we heard from Representative Drazen about one.
Yes, for House, for House Bill 2634, she referenced Senate Bill 118.
And also, I think there were a couple of different issues, Senate Bill 118 and also an amendment to add some agency changes to the House bill. Is that because, well, we'll have to figure out which bill will proceed. Should it be both bills or just one? Correct. So there's that issue. And also possibly something on the broadcaster's bill.
Yes. Definition.
Yeah. So committee, did you know anything else that we might want to be working on or ask LRO to be working on for us before we have any further discussion on any of those bills that we heard today? Okay. Mr. Alanak, anything else we need to cover or take care of before we adjourn for the day?
I would just like to remind the members that tomorrow is the revenue forecast. And there was some back and forth about that, but where we landed was it will be released to House Revenue tomorrow at 3:15. And the Senate Finance and Revenue members will be joining you. It is not a joint committee. House Revenue will meet, and Chair Nathanson will have the gavel and run the meeting. The Senate Finance and Revenue members are invited to attend. And in normal times, all of the members would be sitting at the dais, and here they'll just be in the meeting.
So. Okay. Thank you all. See you tomorrow. We're adjourned.